Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. A wonderful new biography about a very important person in North Carolina life, Chief Justice Susie Marshall Sharp, the first elected Chief Justice of a court anywhere in the United States, lived in North Carolina and is revered. One of our own, one of Orange County's own, Anna Hayes, has written a biography that will be available in a minute, in just a few days, and can be ordered right now if you want to pre-order it. Anna Hayes, tell us about why you decided to write about Susie Sharp.
Well, D.G., it just came out of the blue. I grew up in North Carolina, and I had known about Susie Sharp my entire life on some level. She was just part of the atmosphere. She was such an icon, so well known across the state. I grew up in Raleigh, capital, and around our dinner table, there was often conversation about various personalities in state government or who was doing what to whom, and her name would come up. And so when I grew up and became a lawyer, she was really well embedded in my consciousness. And of course, I'd used her opinions from the Supreme Court in my practice.
I guess her time of service was over about the time you began practicing law. I mean, she was a historical figure.
She retired in 1979, and so she was somewhat in the past. But, I didn't have her on my radar in any conscious way. But one morning, I was getting ready to go to work. I was practicing law in Raleigh. Did not have a thing going through my head except what I had to do that day, combing my hair, looking in the mirror. And all of a sudden, it was as close to being a voice as it could be without being a voice. This thought came to me, just in these words, biography of Susie Sharp. Just like that. I had to stop combing my hair. I put down my comb. I said, where did that come from? No idea. I still don't know. But the more I thought about it, the more it seemed like a good idea, because nobody had done any serious work on her. She had had a million interviews. She'd been on the cover of Time magazine, but no one had done a serious biography. And I didn't know if her papers existed, if I could get them, what sort of path I would have to follow if I were to follow it. But I began sort of investigating it, and it led me to undertaking this huge project, which has been a wonderful project.
Well, we'll talk more in depth about Susie Sharp's life and the chore of writing the book. But it's hard for me to believe, because as a young lawyer myself, while she was active on the court and a real icon, I forget that many people in North Carolina, have no idea who she is. So as you're beginning to prepare to talk about your book, what are you going to say in the first couple of minutes about who she is and why she merited a full-blown biography?
Well, she was truly unique in the literal meaning of that word. The title of the book is Without Precedent, because that's exactly what she was. She was the first woman judge of any sort in North Carolina. And as you indicated in your introduction, she went on to become the first woman elected Chief Justice of a state Supreme Court. She was born in 1907, which is quite a while ago. When she began practicing law in 1929, it would be another 17 years before women in North Carolina could sit on a jury. You have to sort of process that idea.
It's hard to put yourself back.
And she was unusual in that she was a trial attorney as well. That was extremely unusual for a woman.
So she was first a lawyer and then a judge in a time when other women couldn't get into the courtroom to serve on a jury.
In fact, there weren't even any ladies' rooms in the courtrooms, because ladies did not go to the courthouse. And so she was arguing in her cases to all male juries for the first 17 years of her career as an attorney. She practiced law for 20 years. Now, understand, she would not have had a job practicing law if it had not been for her father, who was an attorney.
Why is that, Anna? Why wouldn't she have been able to get a job?
Because in those days, if a woman didn't have a father or a husband to take her into their practice, she would have starved. Susie Sharp herself said that if she had hung out her shingle as a solo practitioner, she would have starved. Now, you have to remember Sandra Day O'Connor, who graduated with high honors in 1952 from Stanford Law School, couldn't get a job in a law firm except as a stenographer. And that was 1952. So that gives you some idea of just how far ahead of the curve she really was.
How did she happen then to be able to be appointed to a judgeship in this time and tradition of sort of a total male dominance of the profession.
Well, that came about through politics. And there again, she was an anomaly. There were other women who were somewhat involved in politics and more all the time, particularly after World War II. But her father was known as Mr. Democrat in Rockingham County. He was a staunch Democratic fixture in that county, and he had done everything you could possibly do to further the party, and she got involved in the activities through him. And by 1944, she had sort of progressed far enough as a political operative to be a campaign manager for Governor Cherry when he ran for governor. And then in 1946, she was the campaign manager in Rockingham County for John Folger when he ran for the U.S. House of Representatives against Thurman Chatham. That was a vicious campaign. It's still legendary. And then in 1948, she and her father and Judge Alan Gwynn from Reidsville were three of the very, very few people in the legal community who supported Carr Scott when he ran for governor. The establishment figure was Charles Johnson, and everyone expected him to win, but he didn't. And so it was Carr Scott who appointed Susie Sharp to the Superior Court bench.
Carr Scott is probably best known as the father of another former governor, Bob Scott, and also famous for his appointment of Frank Graham to the U.S. Senate. He made, and those people who follow Chapel Hill politics and North Carolina politics know that this was quite an unusual appointment, appointing a very liberal person to the U.S. Senate in a very conservative state. But Carr Scott was a populist and a little more liberal and a How would you say he was just willing, he just liked to shock people, I guess.
Well, I think he did, and I'm sure that was part of the reason that he appointed Susie to the bench. He was a maverick, and he loved to get the establishment in an uproar. He'd go around the state, you know, calling the head of the Carolina Power and Light Company, whose name was L.V. Sutton, Low Voltage Sutton, and things like that, just to get people going. And he really was the champion of the farmer and the little guy, the people who lived, they called him the Branchhead Boys, the farmers who lived up where the creek began and didn't have a paved road to get their crops to market, didn't have a telephone. And he was really their champion against the banker's candidate, who was Mr. Johnson.
So Carr Scott was elected in, like, 1948.
Mm-hmm.
And so Susie Sharp's opportunity for appointment as the first female judge in North Carolina, or the first trial, high-level trial judge.
First judge of any sort.
In North Carolina.
Woman,
took
yeah.
place less than 60 years ago.
1949.
And how did she find the courtroom, or the courthouse gang, how did they receive a newly appointed woman?
Well, very well, as it turned out, although, of course, everyone was nervous, not just Susie Sharp, but all of the lawyers and the litigants and folks like that. But it turned out that she knew her stuff, and she could run a courtroom efficiently and fairly, and she knew the law. And even though some of the more flamboyant lawyers couldn't quite get away with all the tricks they'd like to pull on her, they respected her. And she became a very popular judge all across the state. She held court in, I think, something like 64 out of the 100 counties, because she was a special judge as opposed to a regular judge. And special judges filled in for regular judges who were absent from their bench for whatever reason. And so she would go from the mountains to the ocean, get in a car on Sunday afternoon or early Monday morning, and drive all over the state.
She was the kind of judge that, as you say, a special judge. Ordinarily, then and today, Superior Court judges, these high-level trial judges, are elected. They might be originally appointed to a vacant position, but they have to run for election. The special judges are just appointed by the governor.
They're always appointed by the governor and reappointed by the governor. They never have to run.
So she had to be on good terms with the governor to keep her job.
Well, she did, and that was interesting too, because she thought initially, well, I should not accept this appointment, even though her father would probably have killed her if she had turned it down. But it was only at that time a 2-year appointment. And she had just spent 20 years building up a law practice. And her father was getting old and he didn't like to practice law very much anyway. He'd rather have been farming. And the family finances depended on that. She was the oldest of 7 children, all of whom, I will say, went to college and most of them to graduate school. That house got mortgaged over and over again, and finances were a real serious consideration. And she was worried that she would not be able to stay on the bench after the first 2 years. There'd be a different governor or whatever, or she wouldn't be accepted. But in fact, as she went around holding court all across the state, she sort of created a constituency for herself. She was so well known because she was a woman, and the women wouldn't have liked it if she hadn't gotten reappointed. She'd done a very good job. People, had no problem with the way she'd performed the job, and so governor after governor kept reappointing her.
Well, getting back to the time of the original appointment to the bench, were there people, were so resistant to change, were there people who just thought it was immoral for a woman to be in the courtroom as a judge? Was there any active opposition to her that surfaced, or was it just this quiet worry about the change?
There was, chatter in the back halls of the courthouse everywhere she went and so on, but there was no overt opposition. Ironically, there was more opposition to women sitting on the jury. There was a huge uproar about that.
It's hard to go back in time. What was it that we men said about you women that would justify excluding women from serving on the jury? What were our predecessors saying?
Well, it was thought, among other things, that a woman's tender sensibilities would be offended by some of the unsavory things they would have to hear in the courthouse. And it was just deemed unseemly. Women did not have public positions. A school teacher was practically as public as you got. And women didn't particularly want to sit on a jury either. They were pretty horrified once the amendment to the North Carolina Constitution made it possible. They were still so reluctant to do so that probably 90% of them asked to be excused and were broadly excused. And so it was a long time before they really began to serve.
Well, your upcoming book then serves as not just a biography, but as a cultural history of how things have changed in North Carolina. I'm visiting with Anna Hayes. Anna is an expert on Chief Justice Susie Marshall Sharp of North Carolina. And Anna's book, Without Precedent, will be available, not available quite yet, but available shortly. So keep your eye out for it. She and I'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking? This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Anna Hayes, Orange County resident, who is going to be in the news as the author of a new biography of Susie Marshall Sharp, the first elected woman Chief Justice anywhere in the United States. The book is called Without Precedent, and it'll be available shortly. And we're just talking about this person who you decided to write about, Anna.
That's right.
She's a judge. You told us how she got to become a trial judge. And that was extraordinary in itself. Some people might argue it was just as extraordinary as what came later. That is the appointment to the Supreme Court. And did the appointment to the Supreme Court have as much to do with politics as the original appointment to the trial bench?
Well, I don't think it had quite as much to do with politics.
Well, I guess I'm wrong. She was appointed.
Yes, Sanford appointed her.
Okay.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
Well, while she was on the trial court bench, she was supposed to refrain from politics, and she didn't really enjoy the down and dirty part of it, so that was fine with her. But she had built a real constituency, as I said, across the state. And when Terry Sanford appointed her to be the first woman on the North Carolina Supreme Court in 1962, it was his most popular appointment. He said that, and the mail poured in. They had to hire 2 secretaries down at the governor's office to handle the mail. People were absolutely delighted. And
again, just putting it in the context of our community's history, it was at a point where this bubbling up of the women's movement was beginning.
That's right.
But it was still polite and might be strong-willed women, but they were not out there burning bras quite yet.
Well, they were not too far from that, but not quite yet in 62, probably.
So that the popularity of it crossed over. We'd made cultural progress in the sense that we were ready for that.
Yes, I think so. There were one or two people who had maybe thought another candidate would be the one they would support. But in fact, once her name came out as the appointment, they said, "Oh, why didn't we think of that? That's perfect." Mm. And it was really very well received.
Susie Sharp had made friends with lawyers as she traveled across the state serving as judge, but she'd also made friends with all of these men in law school. I know that some of the senior lawyers in my old firm in Charlotte were her good friends, Hugh Lobdell and Bill Covington. These were people who grew up in those school, but somehow or another they had been captivated by this woman. They really, I mean, it was friendship, but they really liked her a lot.
Well, they became very good friends when she was in Chapel Hill. Actually, I think, if I remember correctly, they were in law school shortly after she graduated. She had gone home to practice law with her father. And it was so depressing and so discouraging. And the depression came along and they were so poor. When a job offering came available in the dean's office at the law school, she hightailed it back to Chapel Hill. That was about 18 months after she went to try to practice law, and she stayed down there for 2 years. And I think that's when she became very good friends with those folks.
Not with her colleagues as students, but with the students who she was helping sort of by being the bridge to the administration.
That's right.
In the law school.
That's right. She was quite a
big sister.
A big sister, kind of. Yeah.
Figure.
Well, I think she might have gone out with one or two of them occasionally, too.
Well, that's interesting because, this was a stern but dignified judge, but you didn't think of her as being somebody who had, an outside romantic life or anything. And yet, why didn't she get married? I mean, what was the background of all of this?
Well, when she graduated from high school, she made an announcement, more or less, to anybody who was interested, that she did not intend to marry. She intended to have a career. She didn't think you could do both. She never thought you could do both till the end of her life. When she was in high school, she was kind of a little bit pudgy, and she wore big round glasses and a big old bow on top of her long hair, just sort of pinned up on top of her head. She wasn't as attractive as she would be later when she had worked on herself quite a bit. And she had been a close observer, too, of her mother's life as the mother of seven children. And she had been a babysitter quite a bit of her life. And she had seen about all of that as she felt she really needed to see. And she really did want the career, and she just didn't think she could do both.
She really thought that you couldn't have a successful career and balance the challenges of being a spouse, homemaker, and mother, which would expected of women in those days.
That's sort of the deal? And women's advocates would be furious with her when she would be quoted as saying that, and she would always deny that she'd ever said such a thing. But you can read it in interview after interview after interview. And, she said towards the end of her career when she was Chief Justice, she said, if I'd had a family, you wouldn't be sitting here interviewing me today.
Well, you practice law as a woman, and women must have talked. I mean, you must have talked to your colleagues, your female colleagues, practicing law in Raleigh, and many of whom probably were struggling with this joint responsibility of managing a family, being still expected to take the lead in managing the family, and at the same time trying to advance in the legal careers. I mean, Justice Sharp might have been right.
Well, I think there may be some people today even who would say, I hate to admit it, but, it is really pretty tough. But you don't want to hear that from an icon who is standing as a symbol for what women can do.
Well, talk about her time as a member of the Supreme Court and how that led ultimately to her becoming Chief Justice.
Well, she went on the Supreme Court in 1962, and she had a hard time in the beginning. She had come from the trial court where she never had to write an opinion out, and she found it very difficult to render a written opinion. She struggled with that for a while.
It's hard for non-lawyers to understand this, and I understand exactly what you're talking about, but the judges at the Superior Court judges and the District Court judges, the judges who manage trials, they have to make so many decisions and keep order and then set sentences and work out all kinds of, it's really hard work and it requires great knowledge of the law. And sometimes they do have to write down the reasons that they're making certain decisions so that they can be reviewed. But at the appellate level, at the Supreme Court level, there's no managing the trials, but you have to sit there and write out in great detail the reasons for your decisions. It's a totally sort of the same kind of people do it, but it's a totally different work, isn't it?
It's totally different work. And, well, in the first place, you're looking for error rather than truth. In the trial court, you're looking for truth. At the appellate level, you're looking for error in the trial. And so you've got a whole different mindset to start with. And you have to, of course, render the written opinion. It's entirely different.
So was this hard for her?
It was very hard for her. She really struggled with it. And she was always a slow worker, partly because she was a perfectionist. She was an absolute perfectionist. And so she was reviewing these voluminous records more than her colleagues. And she was, chasing down the very last case that she could find and so on, and refining her writing. And she was also, bedeviled by the thought that whereas, when she began on the trial court bench, she thought people might expect too little of her or not much of her. But once she got elevated to the Supreme Court, she was afraid they expected too much of her. And so that really fed her perfectionist hang up. So,
well, over time, she gained the respect of everyone as a justice and as an appellate court.
Oh, yes. She wrote
judge.
Extremely. She became known as a real scholar on the court, and her opinions were real models of lucidity, and people still refer to them.
Well, one of the things that we argue about judges and what we want from judges, particularly Supreme Court judges, is whether we want them to follow the law or make the law. And how did she come down on
Well,
this?
Now, she would not want to hear you say she had made any law. But
she did.
And it's interesting because she was a rule breaker, but she never wanted to appear that way. And all of her opinions that did move the law in ways that were arguably sort of going over into the legislative side of things were among her most scholarly. I mean, she had more authority in there than you could possibly lift up. And so whenever she did try to push a boundary like that, she really fortified herself with traditional scholarship and with every weapon she had. She always said that if you're going to shoot at the king, you've got to have all the bullets.
You got to be sure you kill him. Well, I think that for lawyers, that's extraordinarily interesting. And for others as well, that what you're saying is that what she did, that she was willing to move the law when it seemed absolutely necessary, but that it could not be done lightly. It had to really, you really had to lay out
well,
in great detail.
It was a very traditional court, and you realize she wasn't the only one, of course, who was making this choice. It was a majority of the court, and she would be in charge of writing a particular opinion, just as other justices on other occasions would write opinions in other cases. So it wasn't just her decision to change the law, but writing for the majority, she had to come up with the scholarship and the reasoning and so on to support the opinion.
Well, now, she's the only woman and the first woman ever to sit on the North Carolina Supreme Court. And there was a collegiality. There was a good old boy. I mean, it was a private men's club.
Absolutely.
And they really had traditions, didn't they, of doing things together. And how did she just become a good old boy?
Well, in a way, although she never relinquished her femininity, she really liked being a woman, and she was a very feminine woman. But, you know, they had a tradition, for example, of every day at lunchtime, the whole Supreme Court, or most of them, would walk down Fayetteville Street to eat lunch together at whichever venue that was popular at whatever point in time. But and so they would sit around at lunch, and she endured more sports talk than any woman, I'm sure, on the planet. But she was impervious to it. She hated sports. Somebody said that until they told her otherwise, she thought the Harlem Globetrotters was a traveling orchestra. And so she really, you know, she just had to endure that. But she was accepted as a member of that group very much, and they all came to respect her. Justice Parker, who was the most conservative, I suppose, and traditional member of the court when she went on it, had always bragged about never having written an original word in an opinion. He was so tied to precedent that, you know, he didn't write an original word. And often, in fact, when she came on the court, he would routinely, you know, object to something that she had written until she began citing one of his opinions in her draft opinion. And that seemed to solve that problem.
She learned a trick. Well, we're visiting with Anna Hayes, and Anna's become an expert on Chief Justice Susie Sharp, very important North Carolinian. And Anna's book, Without Precedent, which is a biography of Justice Sharp, will be out shortly. She and I will continue our conversation after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Anna Hayes is talking to me about Susie Sharp, and Anna lives here in Orange County, and she's written a biography that will be coming out soon called Without Precedent. It's about Susie Marshall Sharp. And it, Anna, when we first started talking, you talked about the challenge, a little bit about the challenge of writing about this woman. What were the, as you got into this job, which has gone on for like 10 years or so, you've worked on this a long time. Tell us about the first encounter with the project and what you found that would help you, and what kind of got in the way of writing this book.
Well, as I mentioned, I didn't really know about her papers or anything else when the idea first occurred to me. And after I had sort of done a little bit of preliminary research and trying to figure things out and what members of her family might still be alive and so on, I went to see her sister, Louise Sharp, who was still living in Reidsville. And I didn't know what to expect because, as some of your listeners may remember, the family had endured a terrible tragedy in which 9 members of the family died by murder and or suicide. And there had been a book written by that about that by Jerry Bledsoe called Bitter Blood, and it was a sensational, horrible,
laid
horrible.
Laid open the family.
It laid open everything. He did a terrific job on it. He'd been reporting the case or the news when it happened for the Greensboro newspaper, and his book did a very, very good job of finding out what had happened and describing it. But I didn't know if I would be welcomed or not as someone wanting to write about any member of the family. But Louise received me with just open arms, essentially, and made available to me all of the papers that were then at the old family house. And Susie Sharp, I don't think, ever threw anything away. There I found notes that she had passed in class as a schoolgirl, along with every letter she'd ever received, and copies of virtually every letter she'd ever written, because she was an early devotee of the typewriter, and she kept copies of her letters. There were scrapbooks and photograph albums. And sitting on the front porch of the old home place there, there were 4 metal cabinets that had the remains of the old Sharp and Sharp law practice files, so I got to go through those. And then in the basement of Norwood E. Robinson, who was the former law partner of her father, I had access to all of the papers that had been transferred from her office at the Supreme Court when she retired as Chief Justice. And so that kept me occupied for quite a while, and I was in the meantime trying to interview everyone who had ever known her across the state. And then she died in 1996, and her brother Kit Sharp called and said, "I think you might want to come over to her apartment where she'd been living in Raleigh, and maybe just see if there's anything here that might be useful." Well, she hadn't thrown away anything from there either, and I boxed up quite a lot of stuff from there and brought it home. And in that treasure trove, I found 40 years of her journals. I found some very special letters. I found some little notebooks in which she had kept some interesting information.
You were inundated.
I was just inundated.
And how'd you sort it out? How did you sort it out?
Well, that was one of my first questions. I grew up in the days where you had index cards to write a term paper with. Well, that just wasn't going to do it in this case. And so just organizing was a main preoccupation for a while. But I just had to do it systematically. I ended up making copies of anything pertinent and filing it in loose-leaf notebooks chronologically. And I had so much that I could almost follow her minute by minute through her days over the decades. It was just quite remarkable. So that was just, it was overwhelming. And then the fact was her journals, which I was very glad to have, were written in shorthand. Now, D.G., I didn't know how to read shorthand.
You were a modern woman.
I was a modern woman, and my mother always told me never to learn typing or shorthand, or that's all you'll ever get to do. So I had learned how to type, but I had never learned shorthand. But I had to embark on a self-taught shorthand course, which I did. And so then I spent about 2 years translating and transcribing the journals.
And you're keeping records of your research not on index cards? Were you using the computer?
Well, thank goodness for the computer. And I couldn't have survived without the computer.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. We're talking to Anna Hayes about Susie Marshall Sharp and Anna's upcoming biography called Without Precedent. And in rummaging through those records, Anna Hayes, you found out some things that would be startling, and we'll visit about some of those things after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Anna Hayes, a fellow Orange County resident, and about to be, I think, one of the most famous Orange County residents because of an upcoming book that she's written called Without Precedent. It's the life of Susie Marshall Sharp. Anna, you were telling us about how tough it was to get into the voluminous papers and get them in order, including having to learn to read shorthand in order to read some of her diaries. Now, the diaries and records and letters gave you access to some of the things which had been secret about Susie and surprising about Justice Susie Sharp. And will you tell us about how you happened onto this information and, you know, when you began to know that you were going to have something extraordinarily special?
Well, you will remember that Susie Sharp was famously a spinster. She had, of course, announced she didn't want to marry, and she didn't. And people often would ask each other, if not her, you know, why she hadn't gotten married, because she was an attractive woman. She liked being a woman. And it just was kind of a mystery. Well, in going through her papers, I came across several categories of things. There was a box in which there were just fragments of letters. They'd been cut up. Somebody had taken scissors and lopped off the tops and the bottoms, had cut out bits in the middle. You know, they were just sort of, you know, holes in these letters. Each fragment, each remnant had been dated by hand in Susie Sharp's hand because the dates had been cut off the top along with the greeting and everything. And they turned out to be letters that she had written to the love of her life, whom she met in law school. They had a little law school romance, but then he broke up with her. And she re-encountered him, or had sort of kept up with him actually a little bit through the years, but 20 years after law school, they had never stopped carrying a torch for each other, and they began an affair, and he was the love of her life. And while she was holding court all over the state, she couldn't see him, so she wrote to him, if not daily, almost daily. And she put a wonderful record of all of her courtroom days and politics and family stuff in these letters, and this she wanted to save for her memoirs. But she had cut out all the mushy parts, or at least most of them. There were still a few in there. And so she had dated each of these things and put them in a box. Well, so that was one big surprise.
You remember the first time you encountered one of these letters and began to think, oh, my gosh, this is more than just a letter
yes.
to a friend.
Oh, yes.
It was quite a
day, and I was stunned, frankly. but intrigued, of course.
Well, tell us what happened. I mean, can you were sitting there in an apartment, or you were
I had this box of letters at home, and I was probably, you know, covered in dust and had my hair pinned up, and I was just wading through all these papers and came to this box full of fragments and just began sort of...
So the first one of those fragments you read, did you understand what...
No. It took me a while, and, you know, it was only when, you know, I began to see, you know, the odd little mushy part that hadn't gotten cut out, and I thought, my, what is this? And then I had to figure out who they were written to, and so it took a little detective work, but it was figurable, outable, and I managed that. But then going through her other papers and journals, it developed that after she'd broken up with her law school sweetheart, she began an affair. This is after she had graduated from law school and had come back to work in Chapel Hill with a former law professor, Millard Breckenridge, and that endured for a good 20 years, and they remained the dearest of friends until death.
And she, Anna, the thing that was surprising to me, I mean, other than that this whole thing is kind of startling, was that with Professor Breckenridge, who was a distinguished law professor, a very fine person and had a wonderful family, that while they were having this affair, she was also very, almost like a member of the family.
Well, she had practically been adopted by the family from the time she was in law school, because he was an advisor to the Law Review and she was an editor of the Law Review, and the Law Review staff would go over to the house to work a lot, and you know, just over the years, they had developed a very, you know, close relationship. And his children would go up to Reidsville to a summer camp and hang out with Susie's brothers and sisters at their age. And it really was a very close relationship in the family. And she remained dear friends with Mrs. Breckenridge.
Just doesn't add up, though, in the sense that we just don't. It's just not possible.
And you know, one of the things, the strongest features of Susie's personality was her loyalty. She was an extremely loyal person, almost to a fault. Okay, so how does that work? I mean, she's in love with one fellow, but she's having an affair with another fellow who's married to somebody else. But she knew that you could love and be loyal to more than one person at a time.
Well, without precedent.
Maybe not without precedent, but in the wider world.
Maybe not. Yeah, particularly these days. That's not all.
Well, no. Further delving into these massive papers reveal that when she went back to Reidsville to practice law at some point, she had also begun an affair with Alan Gwynn, who had been a lawyer and was then a judge. He, in fact, had been her debate coach in high school. He was about 14 years older. And he was a great mentor and a great champion for her ambitions, and one of the people who really, really wanted to see her on the North Carolina Supreme Court. Interestingly, he wanted to see himself on that same court, and at a certain point, their ambitions clashed a bit.
Also a political rival of her, and sometimes ally, but usually a political rival of her father.
A bitter rival. In fact, members of the family never forgave him for some of the political confrontations that he had with her father.
You say that so well in the book, and I often wondered whether or not, in light of your discovery of that relationship, whether that might be some of the hardest things for members of the Sharp family to accept.
I think that's probably going to be true. We'll see.
So just in summary, the subject of your 10-year work, Susie Sharp, in addition to being a distinguished jurist and a wonderful citizen of North Carolina, was maintaining three concurrent love affairs with three married women.
At a certain point, yeah.
And that did as you got to know this woman through research and through really extraordinary access to her thoughts through her diaries and through her letters, have you gotten used to this idea yet?
It took me a while. I have to tell you the truth, DG. I almost gave up the project because I didn't think anyone would believe it. I thought, this is just unbelievable.
Well, it is unbelievable. I mean,
those who knew Susie Sharp can hardly believe it.
Well, I confess, you know, skepticism. I mean, even to this moment, I say, well, Anna, you know, show me the papers.
I will.
This is just really hard to believe. There's no question about it, though. I mean,
absolutely
you're not worried about it.
Absolutely none. No. But, you know, she was a great camouflage artist.
She was able to hide it. Now, this is in the context of modern, you know, of late news. You think if you can hide these things for until you're dead or for a few years, then people are more forgiving of these sort of human failings. Is that the way we feel it?
Well, I suppose that's the way it works. I don't know. She was very fortunate that, you know, it didn't come out in public.
If these things had come out, would there have been people today who say that's her private life, that's fine, didn't affect her public performance? But back then, she would have had to quit, wouldn't she?
Oh, absolutely. I think it would have been the immediate end of her career. She probably would have had to leave North Carolina. I don't see any way she could have survived that.
Was she a private person?
Extremely private, almost secretive.
But she did understand, as a political animal, the necessity of maintaining a public image, didn't she?
Oh, yeah. She cultivated her public image. She was extremely image conscious. She never went out that she didn't have her hat and gloves on. And she, you know, if she said something to you, it was not off the record. Trust me, it was on the record. And she cultivated her image very assiduously, which makes her private life all that more surprising.
Well, amazing story. And your book, Without Precedent, is one that we'll be able to read very, very soon. Thanks, Anna Hayes, for writing the book, and we look forward to reading it. Thanks especially for taking time to give us a little preview today.
Thank you for having me.
Our guest has been Anna Hayes. I want to thank her and thank all of y'all. We'll be back same time tomorrow.